Okay. Other questions about contributory net? Yes. Fair job. Yeah. Yes, and it depends upon the phrasing of the standard. Some say, and it's kind of whether the tie goes to the runner or the tie goes to the fielder. You know, when the parties are found to be 50-50, plaintiff and defendant are both equally at fault, then what? Some say that the plaintiff can recover so long as the plaintiff is not more at fault. Some say the plaintiff can recover if the plaintiff is less at fault than the defendant. So in the former kind, where they say you can recover so long as you're not more at fault, we call that a 50% rule because the plaintiff may be as much as 50% and still recover, whereas the ones that say the plaintiff can only recover if the defendant is more negligent than the plaintiff, we call the 49% rule because the plaintiff can only be 49%. That's the max you can be at fault and still recover. It should actually be 49.99999, but just for purposes of recognizing that if the jury finds them to be 50-50, there are some forms of modified comparative negligence that say, sorry, plaintiff, your claim is barred. And for purposes of the exam, first of all, you should be able to read the statute and figure out what the rule is in this jurisdiction. Is it pure? Is it modified? If it's modified, which form? And then you only care about this to the extent that you either represent the defendant and you're looking for a way you might beat this rap altogether, or you're the plaintiff and you're thinking, is there some circumstance under which, although I can establish liability, my claim will nonetheless be barred? And even if you think it's unlikely that the plaintiff's claim would be barred, as we know, juries have a lot of leeway, and a jury might look at a case where you think the defendant is primarily at fault and say, well, you know, they were both at fault. How do we allocate it? 50-50. And you could be in a jurisdiction, a so-called 49% jurisdiction, that makes that a basis for barring the claim. And you would say, you'd have to say to the plaintiff, you know, there's a risk here that the jury would find you equally at fault, in which case your claim would be barred. And that's pretty scary to a plaintiff, more scary than just getting an inadequate recovery. You know, the jury might reduce your recovery by a whole lot, but the thought that the plaintiff would actually get nothing will often lead the plaintiff to be more malleable in settlement negotiations than if there's at least some assurance that, gee, so long as the jury finds the defendant at fault, at least I'm going to get something out of it. Okay, let's talk about assumption of risk here, because assumption of risk is very confusing, and there are times when I sort of tempted to just skip all of this, because I get to the end of it and sometimes I feel like I haven't made much progress relative to where I started, but we should at least address it. And just to sort of summarize where we're going here, as the court opinions indicate, the concept of assumption of risk has been a source of confusion because it refers to different kinds of things, and one of the ways to get confused is where you use the same term to refer to quite different concepts, and that's true of the use of assumption of risk. And we'll talk about what those different meanings are, but to sort of get us started, we've got this old classic case of Smith versus Baker and Sons to just sort of raise the question. So can somebody tell us about Ms. Russell? And when we're talking about a drill here, this drill seems more like some sort of a wedge or a spike or something. It's not like a drill kind of a thing. Okay. Okay, so the plaintiff's job is to hold this wedge or thing while somebody else is hitting it with a sledgehammer. Tough way to earn a living. Meanwhile, a careless operator drops this heavy stone on him, and he gets hurt. He sues his employer, and the employer's, this is all pre-workers' comp, by the way. It's one of the reasons why workers' comp was so desirable, is how would you decide a case like this under ordinary tort principles? It's quite difficult. But we go back in sort of the mist of time here and try to figure out what principles should be applied. The employer responded to the claim of negligence by arguing, okay, and this is an example of sort of classic common law reasoning that judges decided cases on the basis of these maxims of the law. For example, you know, ignorance of the law does not excuse, or, you know, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. These Latin phrases that sort of contained a little nugget of wisdom. And the Latin phrase here, the maxim of the law that at least Baron Bramwell wants to rely upon is this, my Latin's not too good, but it's volenti non fit injuria. That's the Latin maxim. And what does that mean? Well, yeah, no injury to the willing, or essentially a volunteer, or one who consents, does not suffer . And then this would be, well, injury, a legal injury. It's not like he's protected. The rock actually does him serious injury, but he doesn't suffer any legal injury. So if I step into a boxing ring and somebody punches me in the nose, if I said, oh, gee, this guy punched me in the nose, I want to sue him, you would say, well, wait a minute. A volunteer suffers no legal injury. If that's, you know, you asked for it, you got it, Toyota. If that's the thing you asked for, why are you making a legal complaint about it? Okay. Now, how does that maxim apply in this case? Let's first talk about the majority opinion. Okay, and so when we have the sort of modern interpretation of this, comes under the heading of assumption of risk, and the principle of assumption of risk applies to the voluntary encounter of a known risk. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to say that you voluntarily encountered a risk of which you were unaware. It had to be a known risk. Now, there is a circumstance in which this guy could have been injured where the court says, as to that risk, he was a volunteer, and if he had been injured by that risk, we would treat him as having suffered no legal injury. What kind of risk would that be? As to which the assumption of risk doctrine would apply. Okay, but there's a contrary, change the facts here, not just that he knew about, but a different kind of risk as to which he did know. Mr. Redmond? Yeah, if he got hit by the guy with a sledgehammer, they say, as to that, he assumed the risk. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference between getting whacked by the guy with a sledgehammer versus getting whacked with the guy who's operating this crane, lifting these heavy stones over his head? The court thinks there is a difference. Mr. Henderson?
I think what the court said was he can take precautionary measures against being whacked by a hammer.
Right.
But because he's completely focused on the wedge, he's not looking out for falling stone.
Yeah. So the idea is, you know, you have some control. You can tell, for example, if it's a new guy swinging the sledgehammer who's not real familiar with this, or the guy shows up drunk, or, you know, there's some other... You have some ability to sort of respond to the risk. You can get out of the way. You see the guy swinging the wrong direction, or he loses his footing just as the sledgehammer comes down. You can let go. But there's not a blessed thing he can do about any carelessness in the guy operating the crane. Over that, he has zero control. Now, this argument doesn't persuade Baron Bramwell in dissent. He thinks the maxim does apply. And how does he get there? Yes. It depends on what you call a known risk. And Baron Bramwell, the majority says, in effect, well, he had the capacity to know about the risk of the guy swinging the sledgehammer. He could watch him. He could tell whether he was experienced, whether he was sober, etc. With respect to the guy operating the crane, unknown risk, negligence on his part, the thing slips, etc. He has no way of dealing with it. But Bramwell sort of takes a more wide-angle perspective. Instead of focusing narrowly on what he was doing, Baron Bramwell goes back and says, in effect, when the guy signed up for this work, could he see that stones passed over the workman's head? Was he aware of that risk, or was he aware in general that working around quarries, you're lifting heavy things, there are rock slides, there are all sorts of other risks that occur, and people get hurt. Apparently, says Bramwell, he thought the pay worth the risk. And he says, little thought experiment for you. Suppose he'd gone to his employer and he'd said, you know, this is really dangerous work. I don't know how you can sleep at night just paying your guys 5 shillings a day. I want 6 shillings a day or I quit. Okay, all right, I'll give you 6 shillings a day. Would we say then that he had been paid to compensate him for the risk? Yeah, I think we would. Further thought experiment. Same conversation, but the employer says, I got 6 guys waiting in line for your job. You want it or not? Oh, no, I still want my job. Okay, so it's 5 shillings. Yeah, right, okay. Same result, would it not be? We would say he thought the pay worth the risk. So why are we giving him extra money here? Now, part of the contrast is something that we'll talk about later on in part 3 of the material, starting with chapter 8, which is what's the relationship between tort law and contract law. Oftentimes, you have a claim of negligence on top of what appears to be some kind of agreement or contractual relationship. How do those two systems interact? Can a person bargain for a lower standard of care? Can they, affect their tort liability by some kind of deal that they have made. And Bramwell thinks they can, but the majority thinks, well, in theory they can, but it didn't happen here. Again, the majority sets a relatively high threshold for what's voluntary and what is a known risk, and those are pretty open-ended terms here. How specifically does the plaintiff need to know about something before they can voluntarily encounter it? If you sign up to play high school football, or you sign up for some Himalayan trek, and you know there are risks that you want to go skydiving, or you want to do something else that's hang gliding, you know there's some risks associated with it. How specific does the information have to be about the risk before you can be said to have voluntarily assumed it? Is there, you know, one slight little thing? Well, I knew I was signing up for this, but I didn't realize that the instructor had, you know, gotten the flu. If I'd known the instructor had gotten the flu, I wouldn't have gone because the instructor wasn't as, you know, able to watch me. That changed everything. Again, the majority in Smith versus Baker and Sons say the fact that he didn't know about the crane going over his head changes things relative to people swinging a sledgehammer right next to his ear. And so different courts could take different perspectives on this. But there's another whole question, which is the way in which we want to permit people to bargain for things. Does it bother you that that we're essentially allowing people to give away their rights? If somebody steps into a boxing ring and lets people punch them, they get into a demolition derby, they sign up for some kind of hazardous work, do we say, well, it's a free country, or do we say, no, wait a second, we got to scrutinize this really carefully to make sure people aren't getting exploited? And that's my question at the very end. You know, Bramwell does this little thought experiment, and then he says, what difference is there if the master says, no, I will only give the 5 shillings? None. I am ashamed to argue it. Wherein his shame? What is he ashamed of? Is he ashamed of the fact that he's got a powdered wig and gets to sit on a bench and think about the law all day, and other people have to have these sledgehammers whizzing past their ears to make, you know, some kind of a living I don't think so at all. I think he's ashamed of arguing in this brutal fashion vis-a-vis his fellow judges in powdered wigs. That's what bothers him. He's afraid he's being too relentless. I don't think he has any shame about the fact that he gets to earn his living in a relatively safe environment. Probably Baron Bramwell doesn't even need to sit on the bench to make, you know, he's got what he has. But in any event, the question of the tort system's tolerance for deals, whether you enforce these deals or whether you regard these deals as sort of an excuse for exploitation, is something, again, we'll pick up in Part 3, which asks the whole question, what relevance contract, in effect. Okay, now I want to focus on the 3 different kinds of assumption of risk and how the difference in the kind of assumption of risk changes the way we want them to be treated. That the court will say, this kind of assumption risk gets this kind of treatment, this other kind of assumption risk gets a very different kind of treatment. And we start with Brown versus the San Francisco Ball Club. Mr. Nelson.
The plaintiff was a 46-year-old woman who went to a baseball game with a friend. The friend had provided the tickets for them. There were about 18,000 seats in the stadium, and approximately 5,000 of them had a screen that would protect the fans from the balls. many of the fans preferred the seats that were not behind the screen because they didn't want to obstruct the view. And in fact, the stadium had even set it up, you had to go to a separate window to buy the ones behind the screen and not behind the screen. And the plaintiff claimed her ignorance in the game of baseball and did not understand that the game was dangerous. And so there was a directed verdict for the defendant.
Okay. And what is significant about this kind of assumption risk? What's the unique thing about this?
People go to baseball games and know that balls can come flying into the stands, so she wouldn't voluntarily to a place that it could happen.
Okay. Unlike the guy, at least, you know, it's a little bit different from Smith versus Baker and Sons, that the guy didn't say, oh, I hate those boring desk jobs, you know, where all you do is, you know, copy stuff onto parchment. I want to be out there where there's a little bit of, you know, thrill and excitement. Give me a sledgehammer swinging next to my ear. It makes the day go much faster. But there are things like this baseball game in which something very like that occurs. People have a choice between the safe way of doing things and the exciting way of doing things, and they pick the exciting way. They go out of their way for excitement, which entails greater danger. And it typically has to do with some sort of recreation or, you know, entertainment. So that it's not a utilitarian, how do I get from point A to point B? It's how do I have the most fun? People will drive long distances to get to ski resorts, and then they'll take these, you know, ski lifts to the top of the hill, not look for the safest way to get to the bottom of the hill. They'll look for the, you know, where it's steep and deep. And they go, you know, hurtling off these cliffs and, you know, double black diamond, you know, expert skier runs. They don't want it safe. They want it exciting. And similarly, in this case, the plaintiff says, I don't want to not this particular plaintiff, but baseball patrons in general, many of them go out of their way to get a seat not separated from the action by a screen. So the proper result in this case, where the defendant has given the plaintiff what she asked for, and there's some question, she denies in effect that she purposely asked for this. She claims she was sort of stuck, you know, getting a seat that she didn't really realize was as dangerous as it was. But the defendant is essentially allowed to say, there's a famous line from a Frankfurter, yeah, the timorous may stay at home. You know, like, you know, baseball, don't come to the baseball park. Even in the seats that have, you know, there are seats very far away from the action, it's still possible to get hit. There are some seats that are very dangerous, you know, right along the foul lines, you know, first base and third base. Greatest danger of a line drive being hit by a batter. And you occasionally see people get hit and hurt. But people crave that. They bring their baseball gloves, and they like to be there in the hope that they can catch part of the action. So, again, if this is a situation in which the plaintiff preferred the risk, we conclude, in effect, the defendant wasn't negligent. So even if we ran a learned hand calculus, how much would it cost to put up a screen? Very little. What's the probability of injury? Pretty good. What's the magnitude of the injury? Can be substantial. There's a case a couple of years ago of a girl, I think, in a hockey game, got hit by a hockey puck, 12-year-old girl, something like that, killed by it. And I think they raised the height of the screen in response. But I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of years from now they get lowered again. because there would be, again, the preference of many patrons to have a more exciting, albeit more dangerous, game. They're probably a greater risk from that hockey fan next to them than they are from the you know, the guys with the sticks on the ice, Mr. Beauvais. Right. 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 And again, part of the question is what weight do we give those kinds of boilerplate disclaimers? Suppose the ticket says, you know, in consideration for admission to this game, the patron accepts the risk that on their way home, passing through the dark parking lot, they may get hit by a mugger. For this, we assume no liability. Would you enforce that as well? Probably not. At least your impulse to say people can choose to sit behind an unscreened baseball seat, that's okay. But if somebody gets hit over the head in the parking lot because you're too cheap to put up decent light and all the muggers hang out there to try to whack you, you wouldn't say, well, that's part of the game. So in some circumstances, we're okay with it. In other circumstances, it offends us. But again, the bottom line, where you say the defendant wasn't negligent, we essentially bar the plaintiff's claim. Okay. Now let's look at a second kind of assumption of risk, reflected by Alston versus Bly. And I can summarize this one very quickly for you. The plaintiff's trying to cross an intersection. There's a truck driver who sort of motions to her that she was, that it was safe for her to cross, waves her on, and then she gets hit by another car. So she sues the other car, the truck driver, and so forth, and they in turn respond by saying, hey, this lady assumed the risk. Now, in the instructions to the jury, the court gives a contributory negligence instruction. If she failed to use reasonable care for her own safety, reduce the claim, assign her a percentage of fault. But there's also an instruction here that says it is a defense to an action for personal injury that the plaintiff impliedly assumed a specific risk of harm. This is on page 21, left-hand column, indented part here. A person impliedly assumes the risk of harm if that person knows of a specific risk associated with a course of conduct, understands its nature, and voluntarily chooses to accept the risk by engaging in that conduct. And the plaintiff said, you never should have given that instruction. That's a perfectly appropriate instruction if I were in a situation where, like the unscreened baseball seat, I know of a specific risk, I choose it voluntarily. I show up at Coeur d'Alene Park on a summer afternoon, there are a bunch of guys jostling around playing pickup basketball. I understand the game of basketball. You know, there's a lot of pushing and shoving. There are people who charge the basket. You get in the way, you're going to get knocked over. No one ever, pulls out a form and says, the party of the first part hereby. It's just, I impliedly assume a risk. I know what's going on. I understand its nature. I voluntarily choose to accept it. If I get knocked over in that game, I can hardly sue this person for behaving negligently. They may not get the 2 points they scored on that basket because it's an offensive foul, but I can't sue them for their negligence. I voluntarily assumed that risk. But that's different from this lady crossing the street. She didn't say, oh, I like it when I hit these boring old crosswalks, give me a few trucks to dodge here. That's, no, this is a different meaning of assumption of risk. What do we mean by assumption of risk in this case? We only mean the plaintiff wasn't careful for her own safety. Didn't prefer the risk. We simply say the plaintiff was negligent. If that's all we're talking about, then the proper treatment for that is it's a contributory negligence case. Lose the instruction about assumption of risk. That's what the court says. It was wrong to give an assumption of risk instruction because it gave the impression you could find for the defendant, period, if she voluntarily assumed a known risk. Similarly, my other example is you get in a car with a drunk driver. You go to a party, driver who brought you there, you know, you separate at the party, or maybe you're together at the party. By the time you're leaving the party, lo and behold, this person's really impaired. You realize, do I either embarrass myself, I got to go back, you know, call a cab, you know, make a scene, or do I simply hope that I'll, you know, get through this alive? You voluntarily, you know, again, I impliedly assume a risk of harm if I know of a specific risk. I actually had a conversation. Gee, how much did you have to drink? Oh, I can't remember. I know the risk, okay? I understand its nature, and then I volunteer. Nobody's putting a gun to my head. I could turn around, walk back into the party, say, hey, I've got a cell phone. I could have called a cab. I didn't do it. Should my claim be barred? No. That's just negligence. And I should have my recovery reduced by the extent to which I'm responsible for my own harm. But it makes no sense in that case to bar it. I want to recall for you what the court said in Lee versus Yellow Cab. To the extent that assumption of risk is nothing other than a form of contributory negligence, it merges with it and becomes simply a form of contributory negligence. But of course, that's not all there is to assumption of risk. Some forms of assumption of risk, when the lady sits down in an unscreened baseball seat, we're not saying, hey lady, you're negligent. We're saying, it's a free country. If you like the risk, have at it, but don't complain about it if a ball comes and whacks you in the head. Now there's a third kind, I'm just going to touch on it here just so we have. We'll start with this tomorrow, but I want to at least get it on the table. And this is Kirk versus Washington State. Plaintiff's a cheerleader. The university is supposed to provide her with practice facilities, with a coach who will help people learn how to do the stunts safely. They start out, at least they used to, before the year in question. They started out in the wrestling room practicing these stunts, and after everybody was used to them, knew how to do them, they would then take them out and do them during halftime out there on the AstroTurf at Martin Stadium. This year, somebody got the scheduling all goofed up. They got kicked out of the wrestling room. They're out practicing these stunts on the AstroTurf. And before they know how to do them properly, one of the guys misses or, you know, loses control. She falls and suffers a very serious injury. She says, you negligently failed to provide me with practice facilities and with a coach. And they turn around and say, listen, Kathleen, you're a cheerleader. You volunteered for this. You're barred. You get nothing. Now, this belongs in a category by itself because on the one hand, we can't simply say the defendant gave the plaintiff what she wanted. True, she wanted to do the stunts at halftime, but it's not as though she said, oh, that, you know, wrestling, that practice is for a wuss, you know. I want to do it out there. No, she wanted to do it reasonably safely, nor can we say that she was negligent But there's something lingering here that says it's not fair to make the university pay the whole thing. And indeed, Judge Schultheis, now a member of the Court of Appeals himself, he's gotten a pay grade raise here. Judge Schultheis said, you know what I think we should do is let the jury assign this a relative share of fault. And lo and behold, that's what they did. And when both the plaintiff appealed and the defendant appealed, both saying we get everything, the Supreme Court said, no, we like it. This is a smart way to do it. There's a place for defendant's negligence plus an inherent risk. If that's the combo you have, it's appropriate that there be an allocation of fault. So those are the three basic types. And again, I explain this in more detail in the article if you're really interested in it. But what I want to focus on for exam purposes is, to the extent I can identify it as one or the other of these types, I'm able to predict with some confidence how it's going to turn out. If the plaintiff got exactly what they asked for, they're likely to be barred. If the plaintiff was just plain stupid, it's likely to be treated as contributory negligence. If it's a mixture of some typically sporting activity and some negligence by the defendant, well, we're not exactly sure what the court's doing. Well, I know what the court should do, but they may or may not do it, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow. So we'll see you then. What's that? Yes.